And our special guest tonight, Paul Kimball, we're going to take your phone calls as we talk about the paranormal. His book is called The Other Side of Truth. And as we begin this hour, our final hour, as the clock is ticked, I want to wish our producer, Tom Danheiser, happy birthday. Tom's been with us for going on 15 years now on this show. And he's a delight to work with. He's in charge of our schedule for our travel events. Tom, happy birthday.
Has it really been that long?
Yeah.
Wow.
You
That's
were
a long time.
A kid when you were here.
That's true.
You really were. You really were. And as a present, a lot of people give certain gifts to people. Huh. Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates, has given you a very special birthday gift, which you're going to kick into high action Monday and Tuesday of next week.
He has been so generous. He is going to, if you remember a couple months ago, we had a report from Dr. Sky in a plane, NASA's plane called Sophia.
That's right.
He has invited me to go up in Sophia next week.
And that plane flies for 10 hours.
10 hours all over the United States. It gathers data. It has a giant telescope aboard.
They don't have a bathroom, though.
They do. And we're going to talk to you from up there.
On Tuesday night.
Tuesday night.
Via Skype?
Via Skype.
That's exciting. Are you excited about this?
You know, now I am. It's been in the works for a couple months. So I was like, yeah. But now that it's like the last week, I'm really excited.
Do you have to wear a special uniform or anything like that?
No, but you do have to do a couple hours of training.
Yeah, they want you. Well,
it's a giant.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward to hearing from you Tuesday night as you go all around the country, right?
All around the country. I'll be able to tell you what state we are over.
Good. Check out St. Louis for me.
Sure.
And Detroit. Say hi to my mom while you're up there flying. But anyway, have a happy birthday. And many, many more for you, Tom.
Thank you, George.
All right. That's exciting. You got to believe it. When you're with somebody for nearly 15 years, as I have been with my entire staff, it's truly remarkable to watch their personal growth and what they do. And Tom has just been a great part of this program. Happy birthday. And welcome back. Paul Kimball with us, of course. He is the investigator, the producer, the documentary director. He does it all, and he's the nephew of Stanton Friedman, the father of modern-day ufology. We'll get your calls, too. But, Paul, before we do, I want to get your take on what you think is happening in the animal mutilations phenomenon.
Oh.
It's weird. Weird.
It is. Two things. One, happy birthday to Tom Danheiser.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure dealing with him. He's a top-notch
professional. He's a pro all the way.
Two, animal mutilations. I did a film about them back in 2005, profiling a Canadian investigator named Fern Belzil from Alberta, crusty old cattle rancher. And Fern was convinced that cattle mutilations were real, and that, well, they're real, but that they were paranormal. And that space aliens were involved. So I was not convinced. It is, so I hope folks, when they're listening, I know sometimes, you know, when you're skeptical, it sets people, they're like, "Grr." So ghosts and UFOs, I'm still open-minded to. Cattle mutilations, in terms of a paranormal investigation, or animal mutilations, I didn't see any evidence that would convince me that that's what's going on. In fact, I read a number of reports, and I'm not talking about the Ken Rommel report, but veterinarians, there was a report in the Canadian Veterinary Journal, which animal mutilation researchers either didn't know about or weren't referencing, that basically said most of it could be explained by scavengers and predators, and it's, you know, it's a very long sort of explanation for why. Having said all that, so I don't think it's paranormal. But having said all that, I do still retain a small part of my brain, the part of me that says the governments don't tell us everything, which I think is pretty clear as we see documents continually leaked where we can see the governments don't in fact tell us everything, that it's possible that the government was testing and maybe even still is testing the cattle population in the United States and Canada for mad cow disease. And you know, I've run into people who say, well, if they were testing, why didn't they just test them on their own cattle on their own farm? Well, you'd want to test them throughout the population around the country, I would think. That makes sense to me. So you wouldn't want to let the populace, though, know about it, because we're all carnivores. And you know, if you suddenly even give the faintest hint that there was a problem with the meat supply, you know, we saw what happened to the Canadian beef industry when there were a few cases out west, and it tanked our beef industry. So would the United States government, in conjunction with other governments, have staged these kinds of sort of paranormal things to make them look weird? Because then, as Stan would say, the laughter curtain, people would sort of dismiss it, and they could go about their business largely undetected. Do I think that's what happened? Probably not, but that idea I don't rule out. And I've talked to a number of people over the years in the intelligence communities who don't rule it out either, even though they would say, look, we don't know about it, but it sounds like the kind of thing that, you know, we might do. So, I remember talking to one guy who'd worked for the FBI, and he said, look, I didn't do it, but it does sound like the kind of thing that people I know would do.
And they're capable of doing it.
Yes, absolutely. So, Carl Flock, who was a very good UFO researcher, passed away a number of years ago from Lou Gehrig's disease, was a good friend of mine. Carl was very skeptical. He wrote a book, you know, skeptical on the animal mutilation thing. But Carl was also, he told me once, he said, look, because he used to be a CIA agent, was, an assistant deputy secretary of defense under Reagan, congressional staffer. So he knew a lot about secrecy. And he sat me down and he said, whatever you see today in terms of technology that the military has, you can assume that they had that 10 to 15 years ago. That's what they're letting you know they have. So they have something else that's 10 to 15 years in advance of that right now that they're not telling you about. And I said, well, that's frightening. And he said, yes, you should be frightened because, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that you don't know about and you never will. And, you know, I kind of, even though he didn't apply that to the animal mutilation thing, he said, look, people keep secrets. I was paid to keep secrets for years. And so, you know, if you believe that you know everything that the government's doing, you don't. And maybe animal mutilations, you know, there's a small part of my brain that says that I don't rule that out.
Paul, there is so much going on. We just had the 20th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights. Did you ever investigate that story?
No, I didn't actually, George. I've talked to people. I've met Lynn Katai, for instance, and others who did investigate it. My dad told me many years ago, if you don't know anything about a particular subject, you probably shouldn't say anything. So I'm by no means am I an expert on the Phoenix Lights case. I know people on both sides. Within ufology, I know people who say, look, here's how you explain it. And I'm not talking about skeptics. I mean, people that I would probably class as believers. And then I know people who say, no, that doesn't work, and that explanation doesn't wash. And it's like remote viewing. I've just never really had a chance to look into it. And it wasn't one of those cases that popped up on our top 10 list, for instance, when we did the poll. I don't even think it was in the top 20, because we, at the end of the day, there were about 60 cases that got at least one vote. And the Phoenix Lights was in there somewhere, but I think it was in the 30s. So, you know, it wasn't a case that attracted my attention.
Your uncle's favorite case, I would guess, would be Roswell, would it not?
Yeah, that's a pretty safe bet.
Yep. Let's go to John, truck driving in Iowa now to get things started. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and I want to let you know that I appreciate you and your staff having these shows to keep us all interested.
Thank you, John.
Late night hours.
Well,
hey, my three daughters, they're all adults and got families of their own now. But when they were young, they were all spaced about 3 years apart when we had them. We lived in about a 120-year-old house, and each one of them uniquely had their own imaginary play friend at the time. That we'd hear them upstairs from about between the ages of 2 and 5. So just as one was growing past that stage, the other was coming into it. And they'd talk and play for a long time. And one of them said, who are you talking to up there? You know, just knowing how kids are with play friends. And they told us the name Sarah. And okay, I even got a name for their friend. Didn't think too much about it until some years later, we had a foster daughter come in for a few months, and she was about 2.5 or 3, and like the others, was upstairs playing with her dolls and talking to herself and her dolls. And we asked her who she was talking to, and this was some years later, and she answered the same thing, Sarah. And that kind of sent chills down my spine. I have to admit, I'm a consummate skeptic.
Yeah.
But that certainly gave us pause to think about things. And the odds of her having this communicated to her by our other daughters was negligible. And I guess I'd like to hear your guests' thoughts on that. And I'd also like to know if he thinks that children are more susceptible to contact from the ghosts, or just how they play into that factor.
Good questions. Go ahead, Paul.
Thanks, John. Yeah, that is a good question. I've always thought that kids might be more susceptible or open for a couple of reasons. One, kids are naturally more imaginative than most adults. The older we get, you know, the more we're weighed down by bills to pay and all that sort of stuff. But kids, and I certainly was one of them, free-flowing imagination all the time. So, you know, I had an imaginary friend when I was a kid, too, and a lot of my friends did as well. So I think that factors into it a bit. Not that they imagine these things necessarily, but that they're more open to just the possibilities because they don't have all these other things cluttering up their mind. The other thing that I did look into, and I wrote about a bit in my book, too, is the idea of reincarnation, because again, this what happens to us after we die, so reincarnation kind of fascinates me. And if you come back, if you're reincarnated, you know, do you carry through some of the experiences from your past life? Are you getting echoes of the past life that maybe inform, in this case, John's daughters, their current lives? Who knows? But I remember when I was a kid, I don't talk about this a lot because, you know, it's one of those things where some of my friends look at me and go, you're weird. But I remember as a kid, you know, I would be lying more than once when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, sort of stopped when I hit the double digits. I'd be lying on a couch or on the floor in my bed, and then suddenly I just feel as if I was falling. My stomach, like from a big, like a plane or a cliff or something, my stomach that would be in the pit of my stomach, I could almost, on some occasions, feel air rushing by me. Now, I was perfectly wide awake, and then it would pass. It was a truly frightening experience. And so it disappeared as I got older. And I often wondered, without saying that this is what happened, but, you know, it tweaks my interest. Was this some sort of past life experience that I was still getting echoes of that slowly faded as I moved into this life more? So, yeah, you know, for those reasons and probably a dozen others that I can't think of right now, I do think kids are more open to it, and I certainly talk to a lot of kids in some of these. You have to be careful when you're dealing with children, of course, for a lot of reasons. But if you should treat them with respect and you treat them in the right way, you don't sort of exploit them, then there's a lot of interesting stories that they have to tell, and I think they might be more open than that I am at 50 years old.
They seem to be very sensitive to the paranormal side of the world.
That's a good word for it, sensitive. Yeah, actually, that's the word I was looking for.
There you go. Let's go to Gail in North Carolina. Welcome to the program, Gail. Go ahead.
Thank you, George and Paul.
Sure
I appreciate
thing.
You taking my call. Paul, I'm 50% Native American, raised by my grandmother and my uncle, who taught me their heritage ways. And paranormal just seems to come to me. Like the job I have now, I'm in a house from the 1890s where this town was developed in the 1872 that I'm in. And I was drawn to this house. I should be here for a reason. I'm property caretaker of a 68-acre farm. That's all that's left of the farm from back in the day. And this house is really something. Please, if you will, when you go to a shaman and you learn, you get cleansed, learn how to protect yourself with sage, with sweet grass. Learn a prayer. It'll be very helpful. My husband was a very big skeptic when we first moved to this house, and I told him there was something here. I have a friend that is Irish and Native American, and I invited her to come and cleanse the house the first week that I was here. And the things that she told me have all come true. My husband's not a skeptic anymore. He has seen things fly off the shelves that are 6.5 foot tall, off of our grandfather clock, a piece of ceramic. He now knows. He's also seen our dogs come through after they have passed, and large anomalies. So just protect yourself.
Common sense.
Appreciate what you get to see and hear. And my grandmother was a healer. A lot of people used to go to her, and she would heal by touch and prayer.
Interesting that you bring that up. Paul, ever interview a healer?
Not specifically. I do. I have the greatest respect for the traditions and the beliefs of First Nations people. In fact, I've been to a couple of ceremonies where, you know, the sage ceremony and I'm not getting the, I can't remember the exact name, but they use sage and sweetgrass and that sort of stuff. And I find it very moving. And even though their beliefs might not necessarily be my beliefs, I don't know what my beliefs are. So at least, you know, these other folks have them. I always find it very moving. I find it very touching. I find it sort of almost inspirational that they've held on to their beliefs and culture despite, you know, what Europeans have done to them for 400 years. So, but they have this, there's no question that the First Nations culture, as we would call them here in Canada, have these tremendous oral histories that, because generally they didn't write things down, the tales were passed from generation to generation orally. And as somebody who studied oral research methodology in my graduate degree in history, I find this stuff fascinating. And so I help organize the East Coast Paraconference up here in Canada and Nova Scotia every year.
You've got one coming up in August, don't you?
And we do. We have one coming up in August. And before when they open the conference every time, they bring in First Nations people, and they walk through the entire room with all the conference attendees, and they do the smudging with the sage and those things. And the first time that they did that to me, I said, I sort of thought, you know, is this me finally getting cleansed? So I asked the lady afterwards, and she said, well, this would be your first step. You know, there's a few more that you'll probably need to take given what you've been doing. And I said, well, good, you know, at least I've made the first step. But tremendous, tremendous respect for their traditions, their heritage, and also their belief structure and their openness. I think, you know, they are more open to these stories and to these possibilities than I think traditional Anglo-Saxon Western European culture is.
Paul Kimball with us. Winterlightproductions.com is his website. And we'll be starting another new show called Haunted. How can people watch that?
If you're in Canada, you'll be able to watch it on a network called Eastlink, which is a Canadian network that airs across the country.
Okay.
If you're in the United States or anywhere else, it will eventually show up on Amazon Prime, which is where our old show Ghost Cases, if you want to watch. I mean, Ghost Cases, yeah, we could have done a better job sometimes. There's about 3 of those episodes out of 13 that I can still watch. But you can find it on Amazon Prime.
It's amazing what technology does. Paul, we're going to come back and take final calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, final segment with Paul Kimball. Paul, why do you think so many people are interested in the paranormal, not only to hear the stories, but to maybe participate in them?
That is my favorite question, George, and I think the answer is the same reason I'm interested in it. Because, and I think we touched on this a bit earlier in maybe the first or second segment, but that idea that we all sort of wonder, are we traveling through this life alone? I don't just necessarily mean individually alone, but as a species. So if you want to talk about life on other planets, are we alone in the universe kind of thing, but also in a more existential, very personal way to ourselves, you know, are we at the end of the day, because we're all in our final breath, we all die alone, even if you're surrounded by people. In your final moments, it's just you and whatever might or might not be coming next. And I think that's the kind of thing that all, I mean, it's the one thing as human beings we all have in common, no matter what our politics are or religion or race or gender, we're all going to wind up in the same situation at the end. And so I think at some point in our lives, our attention turns to asking the question, what's waiting for us, if anything, then? And I think that's what draws people into all of the things that I would classify as paranormal, and I would include religion and spirituality and faith in that, sort of the ultimate paranormal thing. But I would also include ghosts, and I would include things like, you know, talking about reincarnation and synchronicities. And if you want to get into the question of are we alone in the universe, I get in, you know, UFOs and space aliens and stuff like that. So I think it's always about trying to find out what our relationship is to whatever the other might or might not be, and if there is another. And I think that's the most personal sort of quest that any of us can undertake. And I, you know, authors and poets and songwriters have undertaken that quest throughout human history as well, often with reference to supernatural or paranormal themes. Shakespeare was notorious for doing that kind of thing, the three witches in Macbeth, for instance. So, you know, that's been with us since the beginning of human history, and I think it'll be with us to the end of human history. It's the one thing that binds us, is that question of, are we alone either in the universe, or are we alone, you know, when it's all over, in terms of where we might or might not be going next.
Paul Hellyer, the former Canadian defense minister, is convinced that we are not alone, that we've been visited. And politically speaking, it would be great to get more and more people involved who could come forward and disclose. I understand you are seeking a seat in the provincial legislature.
Yes, completely unrelated to UFOs or ghosts.
It's not your platform, right?
Yeah, totally. In fact, I'm a longtime critic of Paul Hellyer's. I actually saw him speak here in Halifax before Christmas.
A critic over his UFO beliefs or just his other beliefs?
A little bit from column A and a little bit from column B. If you know his political history, there's a lot to be critical about. Canadians know it more than most people do. But mostly his UFO beliefs. He falls into what I would call the far fringes of UFO belief, where, like, for instance, he was the Minister of Defense during the same time the Sag Harbor incident.
Right, like, okay.
He has always said he never received any reports. He didn't know anything about it when he was in government.
How can that be?
That would be my question. So, but it was only after that he read the, as I recall, he said that he read The Day After Roswell by Philip Corso.
And Bill Burns, yeah.
Which is a very controversial book, and that's all I'll say about it. And then, you know, he sort of latched on to some of the fringier elements of it. I prefer the more evidential elements of it. I guess that's the kindest thing I can say about Paul Hellyer, at the same time as thanking him for his many years of service to my country in the past.
Okay.
He was responsible for building the UFO landing pad in St. Paul, Alberta, though. They actually have a UFO landing pad there. It was built as part of our centennial celebrations in 1967 when the government was giving money to every town across the country to build something. And in St. Paul, which is where Fern Belzil, the cattle mutilation investigator, lived, they built a UFO landing pad. And some of the archives from QFOS, the Center for UFO Studies, wound up there, and I visited there. It's a cool little attraction. So that's, you know, kind of a Paul Hellyer. Even long before he was involved in UFOs, he was sort of involved with UFOs because he built that UFO, or he was responsible for that UFO landing pad. I think he even flew out and he opened it up, as it were.
All right, let's go to final calls. We will go to Allison in Hitchcock, Texas. On the wildcard line. Hello, Allison. Go ahead.
Macau.
Hi there.
I met this guy, unusual. I called my son, and he had one number, which was the last number that's different from his. And then after he come to see me, and I haven't seen him anymore, but we talked on the phone.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I saw his picture appeared on my kitchen window when all the lights, other lights other than my bedroom light.
The picture of the guy, he started appearing his on your window?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
On my window.
Who was he?
And then I see pink flowers every once in a while in the church, also pink flowers at home and blocks. I want to know, could you tell me, was this a paranormal situation or what?
Well, I would say it definitely would be, Paul. Anytime somebody's picture starts showing up on my window, I would think there's something weird going on.
You would think so. You know, like, as with any case or any story, and I know folks sometimes get frustrated with me because I sort of say, I don't know. It's kind of like you when, with your show where you say, look, I just want to give people a platform to talk. So I have my own personal experiences, and those are the only ones I can sort of really dig into. What I like to do, though, and what as a documentary filmmaker I did for many years, and I still do as a politician, is you listen to the stories that people tell you, and you take them seriously, you treat them with respect, which unfortunately I don't think a lot of people do, and you say, I don't know what happened, but something clearly happened to you, and that's of interest, and what, and then I would flip the question back to her, to your listener, and I'd say, well, what do you think happen? Because at the end of the day, it, as my friend Greg Bishop says, it might really be a relationship between whatever the paranormal is and you.
So is that really Greg Bishop, our same Greg Bishop?
It is your same Greg Bishop, who I believe managed to get my New Order regret request in the third segment. So that's the coolest thing that might have ever happened to me, is you played New Order's regret in the segment. Awesome. But, you know, Greg talks about this idea of co-creation between the paranormal. So they throw something out. So maybe she, your listener, maybe she saw something, and then she interprets it in a way that would be completely different than if it had happened to me. So we all sort of get it, and then we all take it and run with it in different directions. And that's, you know, that's part of what makes it really interesting too, because we, as Holly and I did in that jail cell, we can have the same things sort of happen to us and have different reactions and different perceptions of what happened. And that's really interesting.
Let's go to Gene in Columbia, Missouri, first time caller. Gene, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Very well.
I'm just listening to your show here and wanted to maybe throw in a little bit of biblical perspective. I am a creationist, I'll tell you, and I do believe that we were created by a God who has our best interest in mind. And in the Bible, you know, he warns us not to go to mediums or spiritualists because he doesn't want us to open that door. And I think the reason for that is, you know, Satan, if you believe what the Bible says, his first lie to Eve was that you would not surely die, even though God told her she would if she sinned. God says in the Bible that the soul that sins, it will die. Jesus always referred to death as sleep when he was talking about different people like Lazarus. You know, the Bible says that all men live once and then they're judged. And just my thought on why we might be seeing these things is, if the story of sin and Satan is true and he is trying to deceive people, there would really be no better way to deceive them than to impersonate a dead relative. Actually, that happened to my father. His brother was run over by a tractor at a fairly young age. Oh, and that night after the funeral, he woke up and his brother was standing at the end of his bed. And in knowing biblical truth, my father just asked it to leave in the name of Jesus, and it immediately vanished. But, you know, if he had continued an intercourse with that being, who knows where he would have been led.
Well, that's true. That's a good point. And some people, by the way, in terms of ufology, Paul, think that what they're seeing are demonic things up in the skies.
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of people who do put that interpretation on it. And, you know, that's the I guess I keep repeating myself, I'm sorry, but it's 6 o'clock here. But that's the interesting thing, is so many people have so many differing perspectives on it, and none of them can prove that it's true, but most of them think it's true to them. And I think that might actually be the key, that it doesn't really matter what it is. It matters what you think it is and what it means to you. So in that sense, it's like a poem. You know, you can read it. I've actually referred to the paranormal as a thought poem more than once in my career. And, you know, this idea that it means different things to different people. And I think more important than what it might actually be or not be, if it is anything, might be what each individual, and we've had four callers now that probably all have a slightly different spin on it, which I find interesting, is what they take out of it and how it impacts their lives, and does it impact their lives. And if it is, then, you know, generally speaking, I think it's almost always been a positive experience. Even when it's scary, I learned something about myself by having those scary experiences. I tested myself in ways that I didn't think that I ever would. And so, you know, even there, even with something that's truly frightening to me in the moment, it gets me thinking about life after death, or about my place in the universe, or just about whether I can withstand fear. And, you know, I think that's what I take out of it. Other people take different things out of it, but we're all taking something out of it. And I think, as Greg would probably agree with me, that's what's really important.
Let's go to Alvin in Fresno, California now, west of the Rockies. Good morning, Alvin.
Yes, I have three quick questions. Man, thank you for taking my call. This is awesome. Awesome. Hey, George, I've been listening to you for a long time, bro. Like,
thank you, amazing, my friend.
You know what I mean? George, first question for you. Do you guys have a grounds team? Like, do you guys have, like, a team of investigators that go to, you know, like, to confirm, confirmation, you know, wise or something?
I've got Linda Linda Moulton Howe as our lead investigator. Then our guests are really the investigators. So
okay, so I'm trying to, okay, I'm from Fresno, California. I'm trying to blow the lid off of this place. I'm telling you, man, there's a lot of things here, like, oh, man, there's things in the sky. There's things walking among us. There's things underneath us.
Let us know.
There's stories. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So, okay, so, Paul. Paul, have you ever been to Fresno, California?
I actually have. I've driven through Fresno. Unfortunately, I didn't get to stay there.
Okay, there's this place. It's called Wolf Manor. This place was, like, ever since I was a kid, you know, going back to my grandparents being kids, this place has always been haunted, right? So it's a mansion house, and it was used, like, as an insane asylum, like, long time ago. So it was on Ghost Hunters not that long ago, and confirmation, boom. Like, it's really haunted, things there, especially in the basement or whatever, where they used to send the dead bodies, they used to cremate them. My question was, after that show, Ghost Hunters, they tore the manor down.
Yeah, they demolished the thing, didn't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they did, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so my question is... And I have another quick question, too.
Okay, we're going to run out of time, so let's get this one in. Go ahead.
What would happen to, like, the spirits there? Like, you know, because, like, I heard from the show, Ghost Hunters, whatever, there was something very, like, strong there.
Right. You have a haunted place, Paul. It's demolished. What happens to all those ghosts and spirits? They stay, don't they?
I don't know, but I would assume so, because... Let's assume that they really are ghosts and that they do exist. I'm just going to take that leap of faith at 6 o'clock in the morning here. I've been to locations where there have been buildings that have been demolished or burned in fires, and they still have reports of haunted activity continuing long after the buildings are gone. So buildings are just structures, kind of like churches. You know, churches are just buildings at the end of the day. It's what happens inside the church that matters. And I think the same thing is probably true if haunted places are real, and I'm going to go with that for now, that whatever's in there, whatever energy's there, whatever force or whatever spirits are in there, you know, could survive the demolishing of a building, I would think, or burning in a fire. And, you know, I've heard stories of that, you know, like fields, haunted fields, if you will, where there used to be a farmhouse or something there, and it's long gone, but the ghosts and the spirits people still report are there and are still present.
This manor had 22 safety violations, so they kind of forced the owner, who turned it into a haunted house area where people could visit, knocked it down. That was it.
Well, if they had 22 safety violations, it was, you know, maybe even the ghosts would want to get out at that.
I would think so. Paul, good luck. Keep in touch with us, okay? It's always a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you, George. I really enjoyed it. And thanks to everyone for calling in. It's always great to talk to folks.
And his website, and you can see a lot of information, is winterlightproductions.com. It's linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And speaking of things, don't forget to like us on Facebook. That number grows all the time. And follow us on Twitter. You'll get some pretty good tweets. Nothing strange. For Dan Galante, birthday boy Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.